Well, good morning to you all. It is delightful to be here and to be a part of this wonderful Clark lecture series. A special word of thanks to the Weather Committee. Marvelous job. I also want to bring greetings not only from myself, but also my colleagues at Candler School of Theology at Emory University. We're very proud at Candler to be one of the United Methodist Theological Schools. And one of the things that we hammer home to our students is that the United Methodist Church is a connectional church. It's a part of a great community, a wide and broad community. And in our chapel services, we pray for the congregations in the church worldwide, which means that we are in our worship praying for you and your mission. And we covet at Candler your prayers for us and for our mission as well. Thanks for letting me be here today. A few minutes ago, Nancy read for us what is surely one of Jesus' most provocative parables, the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. And let me begin by admitting that I don't think it's going to be easy to figure out exactly what Jesus wants us to get out of that parable, or any of the parables, really. The word parable is a notoriously difficult word to define. It means a lot of things. But one of the best definitions of parable is riddle. A parable is a riddle. There's some mystery to be plumbed, some enigma to be resolved. And the thing is, with Jesus' parables, right when you think you've got it, a trapdoor opens and you fall down to an even deeper level of mystery. By the way, I think insufficient attention is given to the fact that we serve a Lord whose favorite method of teaching was not rule or law or principle, but riddle. According to the Gospel of Mark, he never said anything except in riddles. I think that bothered his disciples, frankly. One day we are told Jesus had been teaching and preaching beside the Sea of Galilee, one parable after another, one riddle after another. And when it was done, his disciples pulled him aside and said to him, "Why did you do that? Why do you talk to them in riddles?" As if to say, if you have something to say to them, why don't you just say it directly? But no, he never said anything except in riddles. The humorist Calvin Trillin once said that he failed high school math because his teacher never understood that he meant his answers ironically. Well, so did Jesus, evidently, because he never said anything except in riddles. The great New Testament scholar C.H. Dodd once came up with a wonderful definition of parable. He said, "A parable is a metaphor or simile drawn from everyday life, the meaning of which is sufficiently in doubt to tease the imagination into faithful thought." Sufficiently in doubt to tease the imagination into faithful thought. But you know, even in the odd world of Jesus' parables, the one that we heard this morning is particularly strange. Most of Jesus' parables are at least about things we know something about. A farmer sows seed in a field. A woman mixes yeast with flour to make bread. A young man tells his father, "I'm sick of this town. Give me my share of the inheritance. I'm going to the city to make a life for myself." That's life. That's human life. We get that. In fact, one of the most popular definitions of parable is that it's an earthly story, a very earthly story with a heavenly meaning. Well, not this one. In fact, most of the action in this parable takes place not in this world, but in the next world. In fact, you might even say instead of being an earthly story with a heavenly meaning, this one is a heavenly story. Or actually, it's a hellish story. Most of the dialogue in this parable takes place in the bowels of Hades. What happens in this story is that there is a rich man, and as Michael said, we don't know what his name is, but we do know how he lives. He wears designer clothing, and he eats whatever he wants to every day. Right at his gate, right at his door, right on his porch, there is a poor man by the name of Lazarus, so desperately hungry that he would love to have pawed through the hefty garbage bags that go out the back door of the mansion every day. But no, there's no indication that the rich man ever saw him, ever noticed him, ever paid him any mind at all. They live only a few feet apart from each other. But they are in different worlds. But then, suddenly, as is so often the case in Jesus' parables, there is a reversal of fortune. Both men die, and the poor man, Lazarus, is carried by the angels, and the Greek text says, into the bosom of Abraham, which is an old Jewish phrase meaning deep into the family of God, right next to the heart of God. The rich man also dies, but he heads in the other direction. He ends up in the Jewish legendary land of the dead, Sheol, Hades, or as we would call it, hell, and in agony there. He looks up, and he sees Lazarus in Abraham's bosom, and he calls out, "Father Abraham, please, I'm in agony here. Send Lazarus with some cool water for my tongue." But Father Abraham says, "Oh, my child, no. You've had your good things in life. What is more, a great chasm has been fixed between us. You can't come to us now, and those of us who would love to come to you, we cannot. It's too late. It's too late. It's too late." Well, what do you think Jesus wants us to get out of that riddle? Well, a good many New Testament scholars point out that this story fits beautifully into a major theme in the Gospel of Luke. Namely, that in the age-old struggle between the rich and the poor, between the haves and the have-nots, God is not neutral. God stands on the side of the poor. They have no one else to stand with them, and God stands with them. And it's true. If we read through the Gospel of Luke with open minds and open hearts, there is more material in Luke's gospel on economic justice than almost anywhere else in Scripture. In fact, so strong is this theme, you get the feeling as you read through that every time Luke uses the word rich, he snorts. Rich. Well, it's true. Right at the beginning of Luke's gospel, when the angel Gabriel comes to the little peasant girl, Mary, to tell her that she's going to be the mother of the long-expected Christ child, she breaks into song. The choir may sing it in a few months at Christmas time. We call it the Magnificat. But it is not a gentle mother's lullaby. It's a political protest song. "My soul magnifies the Lord," she sings. Why? Because God has brought down the rich and the mighty and lifted up the weak and the lowly. The hungry, she sings, God has filled with good things. And the rich, God has sent empty away. Right before Jesus tells our story, he has a fight in the Gospel of Luke with the local clergy. He says to them, "Let me tell you what's wrong with you ministers. You think you can serve two gods, God and money, God and mammon, God and prosperity. Well, you can't. They are rival gods, and they both want your soul. So which will it be, God or money?" Maybe, just maybe, our story is the tragic tale of a man who made the wrong choice. And you know, if that's what Jesus wants us to get out of this riddle, there's something about that that I find very satisfying. In my neighborhood in Atlanta, some of my neighbors in the last few years have lost their homes. They got upside down in their mortgages, and they bear some responsibility for that, but they are also enmeshed in a system greater than they are, and the greed of that system took their homes, and it makes my blood boil. Or maybe you read the same news story that I did about the former professional basketball player in Philadelphia who owes the city thousands of dollars in unpaid parking fines because he parks his luxury cars wherever he wants to. One of the tickets was for parking his Rolls-Royce at Philadelphia Airport for 2 weeks in a handicap slot. And if what Jesus wants us to get is that one day, greedy, self-centered people like that will stand before the bar of God's justice and will hear God's voice say, "Okay, Buster, you've had all the good things in life you're ever going to have. There's something in me that says, yeah." There are only two things that keep me from stopping there. The first is the chill of recognition. Look, I do not think of myself as a rich man. I don't. I am a recently retired teacher and preacher, and believe me, the fixed income is just exactly what you would think. I don't think of myself as a rich man. But if you pull the camera back and look at me in relationship to the population of the earth, I'm right near the top of the pyramid. Or to put it in terms of our story, I wear nice clothes every day, and I eat pretty much whatever I want to. Whatever this story has to say to the rich, it has to say to me. The other reason I can't stop there is that Jesus doesn't stop there. Luke doesn't stop there. No sooner has Jesus told this story than he gets back onto the road to Jerusalem, the road to the cross. And it carries him soon through the town of Jericho, where he encounters an honest-to-God rich man. His name is Zacchaeus, and he is muscle for the Roman IRS. Or as Luke puts it, he was the chief tax collector and he was rich. But he wanted to see Jesus, so he climbed up into a sycamore tree. And when Jesus passed by, he looked up and he saw Zacchaeus up there. And he did not say to him, "Okay, Buster, you've had all the good things in life you're ever going to have." What he said to him was, "Come on down, Zacchaeus, I'm staying at your house today." And before that day was over, Zacchaeus was jumping for joy and justice, and Jesus was saying, "Today salvation has come even to this man, because this man too is in the bosom of Abraham." Chuck! The trap door opens. What is this riddle about? Is it about wealth and poverty? Yes. But it's about something deeper, too. I think the clue to it comes in what Father Abraham said to the rich man. "Oh, my child." That is not the voice of an angry judge. That's the voice of a heartbroken parent. "Oh, my child." I think what this is about is what might be called the penultimate theology of the gospel, the next to last theology of the gospel. The ultimate theology of the gospel is it is never too late. The prodigal daughter, the prodigal son can always come home. The mercy of God is from everlasting to everlasting. There is always a candle in the window in the house of God. It is never too late. But that would be cheap grace if it were not for the penultimate theology of the gospel. That every now and then God opens up a window in life, and there we can see it. What God is doing in the world, and we are invited to be a part of it as a not only as a duty, but also and most of all as a blessing to us. There it is, open before us. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't, but then the window closes, and it's too late. The Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Tracy Kidder wrote a wonderful book called Old Friends. It's a book about life in a New England nursing home. He actually lived for a year in a Boston nursing home doing research for the book. And in the book, he says, there are a lot of people in this nursing home who are plagued by the loss of memory. There is one man here, his name is Art, who is plagued by the inability to lose memory. He's just lost his wife of 60 years, and he is tormented by memories of failure in their marriage. He remembers that when they were newlyweds, she accidentally dropped the frying pan, and he cursed her. If I could have her back, she could drop 100 frying pans. I wouldn't say a thing. He remembers an argument that went on all 60 years in their marriage. She wanted him to tell her more that he loved her. No, no, I don't like to talk about it. I just like to show it. Well, I know, sweetheart, but sometimes I need to hear it. No, no, that ain't my way. I don't like to talk about it. The last week of her life, she went into a coma. He sat beside her bed saying over and over, I love you. I love you. She never said anything back. She never forgave me. The day she died, he was in the room watching television. The Red Sox are losing again. I would have liked it, he said, if she had died in my arms. Some of us understand this very personally. I cannot believe that when I was a young father, I actually got on that airplane and flew somewhere to give a speech to people who no longer remember me or what I said, instead of going to the father-daughter campfire girl banquet that my little girl Melanie was begging me to go to with her. I can't believe I did that. Now that I'm a lot older and a little wiser, I know I made the wrong choice. And I am now ready to go to the father-daughter campfire girl banquet. To which Melanie would say, oh, Daddy, it's too late. I'm not that little girl anymore who needed her father so much that night. You missed it. You missed it. I think when Jesus was a boy, he heard a lot of sermons like this. It was a favorite theme of the old rabbi preachers in the synagogue. They used to love to talk about how God would open up a window of blessing and invite us into it, and then it would close. They even had their favorite sermon illustrations that they used. They were called Eliezer of Damascus stories. Who's Eliezer of Damascus? He's this obscure biblical character mentioned only once by name in the book of Genesis. Abraham's kinsman, Abraham's right-hand man. But the rabbis made up stories that when God wanted to bless the earth, God would say to Father Abraham, send your servant Eliezer of Damascus to earth as a blessing. And Abraham would do it, but Eliezer would always come incognito. He was the goat herd, or the tailor, or the guy next to you on the Delta flight. You have to keep your eyes open if you're going to see Eliezer of Damascus. By the way, if you translate the word and name Eliezer into Greek, it's Lazarus. The blessing of God in the form of a beggar right on the front porch. The rich man needed Lazarus a lot more than Lazarus needed the rich man. But he missed it. Why did he miss it? Same reason we do. Too rich. Too self-sufficient. Too numb to the possibility that God might be breaking through the crust of our lives with a blessing. One of my friends the other night was watching television with her teenage son. She was folding her laundry as they watched. They were watching something stupid on TV. And at one point, her son said something smart. She didn't like it, so she scolded him a little bit. He didn't like that, and so he said something smart to her. She really didn't like that and scolded him hard. He really didn't like that and brought his fist down on the coffee table and jumped up and ran up to his room and slammed the door. And she thought to herself, well, you can just stew in your juices. But then something told her that at that moment there was nothing in the world more important than making peace with her son. So she put down her laundry, and she put down her pride, and she went upstairs and made peace. Don't miss it. Don't miss it.